I'm Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
What's up, everybody?
Hello, welcome back to another episode.
We are so happy to have you here, per usual.
We don't know what the weather's going to be like when this episode comes out, and I think that we need to stop venturing, I guess, and jinxing it for everybody. We are so sorry.
Yeah, I guess the last two episodes or so, we were like, oh, it's getting warm out and blah. And obviously everyone was, I hate the warmth. And it's like, blah, blah, blah. And then this past episode that came out, the murder of Diane Drake, we had a nor'easter. I don't know how much you got where you live, Katie, but where I live, we got 20 inches.
It was definitely close over a foot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it sure as shit felt like that when I was shoveling.
Oh, yeah.
It was very heavy.
It was heavy.
Wet snow. The driving conditions were atrocious.
Yeah.
And I'm going to even go so far as to venture a guess and say that I don't think we've had a storm like that since the blizzard of 1997. In April, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was bad. I worked, I'm back on night shift. I worked Wednesday night and Thursday night. So I, for the first time ever, and this is very common for nurses, you know, there's some point in your career, you're going to stay at the hospital overnight or during the day because of the weather. And I had my first hospital sleepover, and boy, oh boy, it wasn't the worst. I slept on a cot in the exam room for the women's health because they had canceled all the appointments. So I was like, this is great. It was not great. I slept terribly on this crappy little cot that every time I moved, it also moved. And also there's no lock on the door in an exam room. So even though I put up a sign, somebody did come in and go through the cabinets. They completely disregarded me being there asleep despite the signs. And you'd think like once you go in there and be like, oh, someone's sleeping right here because of the storm, you'd be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, and like back out. No, he just kept going through the cabinets until he found what he wanted and didn't acknowledge me and then left. And I was like, it's just another Thursday at this wonderful, I've chosen this is my dream job. This is what I wanted to do. I'm here sleeping on this exam room floor because I wanted to be here. So anyway, let's never talk about the weather again. We already know I hate being warm, and what I hate more, I think, is sleeping in the hospital. So let's not.
Yeah. What I hate is losing power, and by losing power, I mean losing heat. I live in it's like a weird setup, but it's technically an apartment. So my building, per se, we don't have a generator or anything. And it wasn't the worst because I live in a city, quote unquote, if you can call any city a city in New Hampshire. But I had city water, so I didn't have a well or anything. So I had access to water, which was huge.
Great.
Huge compared to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that 43% of Maine lost power.
Oh, yeah. Most of my coworkers did not have power for days.
Days, plural.
I was not one of them.
Thank God.
Didn't matter. I was at the hospital.
Right. Oh, my God. I had to shower we have one shower upstairs in the office building, yeah, which thank God, because after working, I am not getting cozy under blankets or like even putting on my nice sweatshirt and laying on my couch or in my bed unless I have showered.
Sure.
So I messaged my bosses. I'm like, if you see me on the security cameras scurrying in to take a shower, please don't be alarmed.
Right.
Like, I'm not burglarizing the place. I'm coming to take a shower and get clean after the day that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
So I get home from my shower. I'm just adding the blankets, temperature's dropping. And I'm also being dramatic because it did not get colder than 50 degrees. And
that is freezing. What are you talking about?
And everybody I told that to was like, oh, Katie, you're such a bitch. You're such a pussy. Please grow up.
I love being cold, and that is freezing.
I'm not even kidding you. I took my melatonin at 8:30 that night. My cat Salem was pressed against me underneath blankets, siphoning my body heat. She was cold. Yeah. She has fur. She was being dramatic too. She's fine. But I grabbed her. I more so wanted her warmth.
Sure, of course.
We're under five blankets. I'm shivering. I'm texting one of my friends. I'm like, I think I can see my breath. Like, I'm being ridiculous. And in my head, I'm like, do I call 911? And then I'm like, Katie, Come on now.
It's time to pass away.
Come on. Close your eyes. Go to bed. And then thank the Lord. My power came. I've never slept so good. My power came back on. Salem ran to one of the floor vents.
Yeah.
And like lay on top of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I was so grateful to just have had running water.
Sure.
But shoveling that snow, dude. And then I was driving around to see patients that day.
Yeah.
So on my way in, I go to turn into the first nursing home to see patients. There's a tree down blocking the driveway.
Yeah.
I managed to get in. I'm driving over live wires, which you're not supposed to do.
No, no.
But I'm like, I have an actively dying hospice patient. Yeah. This wire can suck it.
Yep.
So I was like driving around, trees down everywhere, slipping and sliding.
Katie, we chose professions where we are not allowed to say the weather is an excuse to stay home. Like, you cannot. That's why you drive over live wires and I slept in an exam room. There's no option.
Mm-hmm.
It's the worst. Like, why did we choose this job?
I'm not even kidding you. There was one point where I'm like, could I just not have gone to bartending school?
Yeah, right.
I would like to be a barista.
Sure.
Why am I not sitting at home right now because my coffee shop is closed?
Right. Like, honestly.
I know, but we made it and
here we are.
Here we are. And we're sorry for jinxing it and bringing on a record-breaking storm. And, you know, we thought that spring was here and,
well,
we just had to, you know, it's New England.
It's fine. It's
New England. That's all I have to say.
It's fine. Everything's fine. I actually do have some friends, my boyfriend's, like one of his best friends and his girlfriend, shout out to them. They still do not have power.
No.
Yeah. Dead serious. They live in a very rural, we call it the boonies here in Maine. They do not have power. They're actually projected to get power back on Tuesday. So we're recording this on Sunday. The crazy storm happened on Thursday. So that's a long time.
I'd be dead.
And they have a little corgi. Like, they have a little pup. So, like, they are miserable out in the boonies. Yeah.
I'd be in a hotel room.
Well, you know, because they go and they fix the major areas. And then if it's like a neighborhood of 14 people or whatever, that's last priority. Who cares, you know? I feel terrible.
Oh, my God.
It's fucking bad.
And to give the power crews credit, I know we love to bitch and moan. They
work.
I'm the first one. I was watching neighborhoods around me from out my window. Lights are coming on and I can hear people shutting off their generators.
Sure.
And I'm sitting there, teeth chattering. I'm like, please, Eversource, please.
Yeah, right.
But there were crews coming up from other states to help out.
Yeah.
And then all over their social media, Eversource was like, it can take up to 12 hours to replace one telephone pole.
I believe it.
In good conditions.
I believe it.
In the wet, heavy snow. Oh, I do not. Those are our true first responders and heroes.
Oh, yeah.
They are among the first responders that are out there.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God for our linemen?
Linemen?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say our men in hard hats. Because it's true. It's so true. They do the hard shit. And that snow, it wasn't a fluffy snow. It had been raining right prior to it. And then as soon as it got to freezing temperatures, it was snow. Like, it was a very deep. And then as soon as it was not freezing temperature, it got back to rain.
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
It was fucking dense.
Yeah. It was like 36 hours of some sort of precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad.
Oh, shoveling that shit.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm youthful. Okay.
Sure.
I felt old laying in bed, feeling my back after I was shoveling that shit.
Oh.
And then we're recording this on Sunday the 7th. We have an eclipse.
Tomorrow.
Right?
Yeah.
Monday the 8th.
Yeah.
That's going to be wild.
Yeah. How long is it supposed to last?
I'm going up to Vermont to see it for like the totality.
Sure.
And it's supposed to start partial at like, I want to say around 2:30 ballpark. Mm-hmm. And then around 3:30 ballpark is when it's totality. So it'll get dark.
Okay.
And then it'll get cold.
Oh.
And the sun will totally be blocked.
Whoa.
And that's supposed to last no more than 4 minutes.
Wow.
And then you can watch the rest of the eclipse for like another hour after that.
Wow, it's all during my nap time, my pre-work nap time.
I know.
Which is literally like 2 to 5. Damn it. Maybe I'll wake up just to look outside and see. I'll be like, it's so dark.
Do you have the glasses?
No.
Oh, then don't look at it.
Okay, great. Then I'll just be
asleep. Then you're fine.
Asleep.
I'll send you pictures.
Of just the darkness? Okay. That's fine. It's great. So anyway, for us, no more weather. we can talk about the solar eclipse all we want, because that's not a prediction. That's just something that's happening. But in essence, in short, the solar eclipse, is very cool. That's neat. That doesn't happen very often at all. Love it. Great. Going to Vermont to see that, that's awesome. However, a nor'easter, while not uncommon for New England, by any means, April nor'easters, not a fan. Anyway, before we get into our awful case today, per usual, Katie, tell us about some lovely things that our lovely listeners have given us.
Yes. So George S. bought us two coffees and then two more coffees and two more coffees after that for our last three episodes. Thank you so much, George.
George, thank you.
And then Lisa bought us five coffees and she wrote in her little message, "You both deserve some love and kindness. Thanks for all you do to help bring attention to important cases. Keep up your excellent work."
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks, George. Hi. Thanks, you guys.
Very kind. You guys make me makes my day.
So nice.
So kind. Love it. And unfortunately, today that's not super lovely is this story. Although, luckily, we do have a resolution, which is wonderful. That does make it a little better. That's for sure. So stick around. It is interesting. And I think the fact that we have a resolution is a great, but also it's a long-winded resolution. It took a while to get here. It's one of those stories that DNA, man, it's a crazy, crazy thing. And without further ado, today we will be covering
the murders of George and Catherine Peacock.
All right, Katie, it would be humbling of me if I didn't sit here and get on my knees and beg you for your sources. I would be so humbled.
Liz, you can stay seated in your chair. You do not have to get on your knees for anything, but especially not my sources, because here they are.
Oh, great.
I have information from CBS News, Cairo7.com, newspapers.com. It was a clipping from an article in the Brattleboro Reformer, ABC7Chicago.com, the Bennington Banner, lawandcrime.com, and vermontjudiciary.com.
Wonderful. I also used that same, well, I was going to say article, but that same document from the vermontjudiciary.org. The Vermont Supreme Court, essentially. I also used an article from the Bennington Banner, one from the actual website, and then an article from the Bennington Banner from 1989. I used a Rutland Daily Herald article from 1989. I used an article from the Brattleboro Reformer, also from 1989. I really went in there. As well as an article from VT Digger and an article from Fox 23. I really went in.
Beautiful.
Deep inside the minds of, well, newspapers.com, which is where I got those articles from, and just the Vermont Supreme Court, really, I think, was a large part of it. All right, let's get started, Katie, and we'll do it how we always do, almost always, setting the scene. The town of Danby, Vermont was always quiet, always peaceful. Small and rural, just like most of the state, of course. Most of the businesses were local. Most of the communities were close-knit, welcoming. We know how it is. In towns like these, as we know, everybody knows everybody. You could know everybody. It was easy. That doesn't necessarily mean you knew everybody as far as, like, you know, every detail of their life, but maybe you, like, you knew their names, names of their kids, what they did for work, etc. And that was no exception for the town of Danby. Off of Route 7, behind a small home, used previously as a store, sat a two-story red house where a family exactly like I just described lived. George and Catherine Peacock, 76 and 73 respectively, had lived in the town for quite some years. They were private but known, as they had been employed there and raised three daughters around the area. The couple was known to have a happy, loving relationship. They were apparently strong in their faith. and considerate and helpful to anyone who needed them. Both Catherine and George were retired, but in true, hard-working, older generation fashion, once they stopped working, they started working again. And we all have a grandparent like this. It's one of those things where they retire, and then like literally 2 weeks later, they're like, I'm bored. I just want to work at like as a cashier or like doing something just a few days a week, I promise. And then they do until they die. It's just so true. My grandfather is just like that. He just recently retired at 85 because he, for the second time, retiring from the same job already.
It's like they retire officially and then they do something chill. Like still make a little bit of money. Or yeah. I know some people who like volunteer.
Yeah.
They go pet the cats at the animal shelter or go hang out at the local library and just kind of help do stuff there. It's really cute.
It's very cute and very nice.
Yeah.
I love it. Catherine had spent 14 years as a cashier at the Benjamin Franklin store in Manchester, Vermont before she retired. When two of their three daughters were home from college, they actually would work there too, which is pretty neat. Meanwhile, George was a desk clerk 3 days a week at a local hotel known as the Rutland Lodge. According to his manager, George was extremely reliable and always on time. You could virtually set your watch by George, he said, which I personally loved to hear because that just was so cute. But I think that was just so funny because it's always the same. They always just get bored and volunteer or get back to just working. I get it, though. I don't think I could ever not do something.
Same.
You get bored. You can only puzzle for so long. My grandmother was one of those people who could be bored. You know, like she retired, I think it was like 04, 05, and she never worked again. And she was fine with that. She puzzled. She sure did. She loved her puzzles. And she quilted for a long time. And that was perfect for her. She was someone who could just hang around and be totally fine. I cannot share that sentiment. And neither could her husband. He, again, just retired at 85.
So funny.
And that is after. So he went from working full time to part time to then like 2-3 days a week. So, and that was, again, after retiring from that same job already. Like he can't. And I get it. And now he's bored. He is. And I'm almost worried he's going to start working again. Instead, he's been walking like all day. He goes around his neighborhood with his walker and just walks all day. And I'm like, okay, as long as you're not falling down, it's fine. And, you know, it's good for you. So, and he has his puppy, his dog that he loves to play with. So that's good. But it's like, it's the same thing. And I feel like George and Catherine were just very similar in this regard. It's like, I cannot sit still. And good. Great. I get it. And it's better to be active. I love that. Love it.
Such a nice couple. Very, you know, quiet, kept to themselves, but very kind and friendly. And a lot of people knew them too, I feel like, because again, even though they were retired, we're putting the retired in air quotes, they owned a little gift shop at the end of their driveway. So they sold like gifts and probably jars of jam and little books and things.
Tchotchkes.
Like little, yeah, little things.
Just
so
things.
Catherine would go down and George would be at the inn or the lodge.
Right, yeah.
And then they'd take turns with the store. And so people kind of knew them too. Like they'd just pull over for a book or one of them would be there. They'd just be shooting the shit. So very kind and nice and just a friendly little couple. And they did like to keep to themselves, but, you know, friendly with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, it was a small town and everybody knew everybody, but it wasn't like you had to know. That doesn't mean you had to know everyone's, like, birth flower, you know, and, like, that they lost their virginity at 14. It just means that, like, you know their names. You know that, like, oh, they do this for work and, like, oh, they had three daughters. Like, it's just very, like, a nice small community.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is what was happening here. And so on Sunday, September 17th of 1989, when George didn't show up to work, like clockwork, his coworkers were immediately worried. They were like, this is so bizarre. And again, George was 76. So it was like, okay, this could be really alarming because what if something happened? Like, what if he fell? What if Catherine fell? What if, you know, and they didn't have they had telephones, of course, but it wasn't like cell phones. So maybe they rushed to the hospital. Maybe they didn't have access to a phone. Like, it was a whole bunch of worries right there. Of course.
So George's coworkers are concerned. And at the same time, one of their neighbors, Jay Kidwell, was also concerned because he's just kind of used to seeing them putz around and walk down to the end of the driveway to check on the little store or George going to work and
gardening. I'm imagining he's big. Yeah.
Just kind of doing stuff. And so Jay was sitting at home and he's like, you know what? I haven't seen George since 4 days ago when he was out mowing his lawn. That's weird.
Yeah.
Let me go check on them. They're elderly. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen them. Got a weird feeling.
Yeah.
So Jay goes over to the house and he's peering inside and he sees George on the floor and he's looking through the front porch window and George is just lying there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh my God, he must have fallen and can't get up. Like, he must have hurt himself. Mm-hmm. I got to get in there. And the doors are locked. The windows are locked. Mm-hmm. But Jay was thinking really quickly. And I don't know if I even would have thought about this. So
I, no way.
Yeah. He was like, holy shit. They have a garage door opener on their sun visor in their car.
Genius.
So thank God that he left the car door unlocked. So Jay opens up the car door, uses the garage door opener and gets inside. Mm-hmm. And he runs in the house and he's like, George, George, George. And he realizes that George is bleeding and is no longer breathing. Mm-hmm. And Jay realizes that George had been stabbed multiple times.
Yeah, he definitely did not fall down the stairs, which at that point would have been like best case scenario. He was gone.
So now he's like, holy shit, what about Catherine? And he's looking all around, runs upstairs, and he finds Catherine's body in a spare bedroom. And she, too, had been stabbed multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Autopsy said that the knife was a double-edged knife less than an inch wide. There was also a significant amount of blood throughout the home, blood splatter, pools, and there was notably a bloody shoe print found. So police were all over that.
Yeah, great.
And police, neighbors, people who knew the couple, just kind of vaguely from around town, they all were thinking, holy shit, everybody knows that this couple is a quiet, sweet, elderly couple. What if this is some kind of sadistic robbery gone wrong? Like, yeah. What if some sicko broke into the house to rob two innocent, cute old people?
Yeah.
And then it went wrong and this robber freaked out and stabbed them.
Yeah.
Jay Kidwell told the Associated Press that the Peacocks kept their home, quote, neat as a pin, but that George's wallet had been found next to his body and his rear pocket was ripped.
Mm.
So it looks like someone had maybe tried to grab the wallet and left it behind. But the fact that the wallet was still there was really interesting because that pointed to it not being a robbery.
Yes.
And then family members, you know, the police went in and investigated, did their thing, and family members went through the house with police after the murders and after their initial investigation, told reporters that the only other items in the home that were disturbed were Catherine's purse and her wallet and potentially a footlocker in the bedroom, the spare bedroom, where Catherine's body was found.
Mm-hmm.
There had been an increase in break-ins in general in the town, even though it's quiet, small, Vermont. People are breaking in other places.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that too made people think that initially this was a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh shit, there had been a break-in down the road or across town.
Yeah.
Now they broke into the Peacock's home.
Yes.
But family, they're kind of thinking to themselves, they're like, this is really strange. You know, even though they're an old elderly couple and one might think that maybe they're an easy target for a robbery, they took their security very seriously. They did not fuck around.
No.
They locked the doors, locked their windows,
mm-hmm.
kept everything neat and safe. And they were not the type to just kind of, oh, la, 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 it's a small town in Vermont. We're just going to leave our door open. They did not mess around.
Yeah.
So there also were no signs of forced entry. So because of all this kind of being pieced together, they started to rule out that it was a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
Danby Select board chair Bradley Bender, who had been leasing a building across the highway US Route 7 from the Peacock's home in 1989, said that once the police ruled out that it was not a robbery gone wrong, there were a lot of rumors going around town, as they do, especially in a small town, especially in small town New England. especially in a town that everybody knows everybody, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
People are running their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to happen. He stated, quote, word on the street was that they didn't believe in banks and had a lot of cash on hand and that someone close to them knew about it.
Yeah.
So it was not a robbery. It was a family member.
Yeah.
That was the gossip going around, is that it was a family member. Their own family went in and knew that they had cash under the floorboards or under the mattress.
Right.
Like an old elderly couple. They don't want to go to the bank. They don't really trust the system.
Yeah,
and what's going to happen, yada, yada. Maybe vaguely remember the 1920s.
Sure.
Vaguely.
Sure.
So they're shoving cash behind the toilet bowl or under mattresses. Uh-huh. And one of their family members knew about that.
Yeah.
And maybe was going to go in to get the cash.
Oh, yeah. My grandfather just more in the last recent years stopped going to the bank 5 times a week. I'm dead serious. Because he didn't trust the bank. It's just something with people who are more new to, like, bank cards and, like, electronic money. Because it's like, what do you mean there's $500 in this card? I need to see it. I don't trust that they're keeping my money safe. So he would go to the bank every day to make sure his money was still there. He's gotten better. It's every Friday now. But, you know, it's just one of those things that it's like, it's hard to gain that trust. So I can kind of not understand, but like, I get it. So when the town, per se, like the newspapers were reporting, like, okay, here are some theories. Robbery, maybe. Most likely it's a family member. The town didn't really give a shit what the police thought. All they really knew is that they were scared. They really leaned into the robbery theory as much as like any theory. That was kind of what they were all leaning into. And they were all really scared to the point that about a month after the murders, they made a petition. It was signed by an alarmingly large amount of the citizens in the community. And the petition really was basically demanding that the entire town and community be provided with increased police protection. They also decided to loop in, while they were writing a petition, about this little tiny section about how in the past few years there had been a rise in vandalism. They just kind of like grouped that in there because, well, it's not every day you write a petition, so they wanted to get every part that they needed kind of in there. The petition states the following. We are angry, angry, angry. We do not want to hear platitudes or excuses or mealy mouth mumblings of budgetary concerns. Yep, you can tell that was written into the 1980s because...
Mealy mouth mumblings.
Yep.
I'm going to have to use that.
Right? I was like, mealy mouth? What the hell? I know. So, as it often goes with a small community being hit by a major crime like that, people were saying, you know, the doors that were once open 24/7 became locked during the days and the nights. Every sound that was unfamiliar was checked out with a weapon hidden behind their back, you know, just in case. Those who lived alone lived in terror. Some people were even reporting that, like, they kept an extra eye, like, on their elderly neighbors who maybe lived alone, just in case this was a killer who, like, sought out the elderly, things like that. Even Jay Kidwell said at the time of, like, the murders and, like, the discovery, he said everybody was packing ire because everyone was just scared. It didn't happen in Danby, Vermont, especially not to the elderly, which I think kind of immediately to me pointed to it being a family member. Plus the whole bank situation and the fact they did have money at home, you know, like it could very well could have been a robbery done by a family member. And because of the outcry from the public and how angry, angry, angry they were, it got a lot of investigative discovery and attention from the police because everyone was like, hello, what are you doing? So they were immediately like, okay, let's go about this. Like, we're not discounting anything like tips. We'll look into it. We're like, we're going to go right on it, you know? And even though the whole town and even the neighboring towns were so scared of the robbery, you know, just like you said, Katie, they kind of very quickly ruled it out. And now we kind of have this like thought process, like, okay, it was obviously a family member. And okay, which family member was it? They had three adult daughters. And as we all know, women are always innocent. So at least in the 1980s, right? You can't have a woman commit a crime. So it's unclear how many people they interviewed or who they interviewed, but I kind of was speculating, like, they probably interviewed son-in-laws, cousins, uncles, nephews, like any man mm-hmm. in their lives, and probably like maybe coworkers. Maybe they had an employee at their gift shop. Who knows? Things like that. And that was all by October of 1989, which was just weeks after they were discovered, murdered.
Witnesses reported to police that they had seen a tan car near the couple's home around the day of the murders, and police had gotten multiple tips about the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, don't know if this is helpful, a tan car.
Mm.
Hey, not sure if you need to know about this. I know what cars normally drive down that road. A tan car is not usually one of them. Saw a tan car lurking around where they shouldn't have been lurking. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's important.
Mm-hmm.
46-year-old Michael Anthony Louise was married to the couple's oldest daughter at the time, and he happened to drive a tan 1986 Chevrolet Celebrity at the time of the crime. He was identified as a potential suspect 2 weeks after George and Catherine were murdered.
So they were on it.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressed.
Shortly after Michael caught wind that police had information about a tan car, not really that they were looking into him, maybe that they'd like to talk to him just to rule him out,
mm-hmm.
he heard a little rumor that police would be going through toll slips, which back in the day, it was a common police practice to use these toll slips, per se, to check long-distance phone records.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael heard about this. He became really upset.
Mm-hmm.
And he started freaking out. He heard that police would be looking for his toll slips in the New York Thruway system because he indeed traveled through New York mm-hmm. to Vermont on the day of the murders.
Mm-hmm.
After hearing of this, Michael left home and left a suicide note where he had written that he loved his wife and was innocent in the murders of her parents.
Wow. What a note.
And she read that. She's like, I never said you were involved in the murders of my parents. Like, why are you writing this?
Mm-hmm.
He did not end up committing suicide, and the police ended up chatting with him the very next day. And he told them, yes, he went on a nice long drive up through New York.
Mm.
Check the toll slips. I was in New York. Mm. I'll admit it.
You caught me. I was driving through my, because they lived in New York. So he was like, you caught me. I was driving through New York. Guilty as charged, but I would never drive to Vermont. Right. Like, it was just so he was, like, doing that thing mm-hmm. that people who are guilty do, where they admit partial truths to kind of get as much as they can to seem innocent, and then they omit the bad part.
Mm-hmm. He was like, actually, it's so crazy that you guys are talking to me because I was thinking, considering about going to the Peacock's home because they have some boards mm-hmm. that I was going to take for a construction project.
Yep.
And he said he started the trip,
yep.
was going on the route from New York to Vermont, like way up there
mm-hmm.
to go to Vermont,
yep.
but then simply changed his mind,
yeah.
went home,
yeah.
turned around in Saratoga, back home.
Yep. Easy.
The time that he had told police he left on the drive to start the drive and the estimated time the Peacocks were killed was roughly how long it would take him to make the trip from Liverpool, New York, where he lived, to Danbury, Vermont.
Mm.
He also admitted to throwing a gun into a river and throwing away his work boots. But he said, unrelated, I just, whoopsie. Gun slipped out of my hand into the water.
Sure.
Fine.
It happens to everyone. I can't tell you how many guns I've lost in the river. My God, it's becoming expensive.
Just a little whoopsie daisy that I do sometimes, you know, everybody, one of those mistakes we all make.
Yes, I know. It's like when you like, oh, I put dish detergent in the laundry machine. Oh my God, this is so embarrassing for me. It's just another gun in the river.
And he also said that the work boots hurt his feet.
Yeah, mine do too.
And so police asked him, they said, okay, well, do you think that there's any possibility that you might have blacked out and killed the peacocks? Like, is that part of your personality? Do you get angry and like get worked up and then forget things, or like do something and then realize that you weren't really aware of what was going on when you did that? And he goes, yeah, I thought about that.
Huh?
And they're like, oh, okay. Usually people who black out, like they're pretty aware of that, something that they do. And like, what do you mean you were thinking about that was a possibility?
That to me sounds like he was saying, like, I've thought about that as a possible excuse to use in a police interview. Yes. About the murder of my in-laws. Yeah.
Yes. And then police also interviewed Michael's niece, Patricia Gannon, who told them that Michael had an in-depth conversation with her about how he indeed blacked out and drove to Vermont on the day of the murders. And so this is totally opposite of what Michael told police. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, you're like our number one suspect right now. And then coworkers of Michael's, they talk to them, mm-hmm. like, hey, what's this Michael character? Is he a good worker? Is he reliable? Mm-hmm. Was he at work on the day of the murders? And his coworkers were like, wow, you know, it's really interesting that you're asking us about Michael, because we all were talking amongst ourselves and mm-hmm. we thought that it was really weird, because Michael, like, one of his things, one of the things that we know most about him is that he wears these work boots every single day without fail.
Yeah.
He's like a lunatic about these work boots. He is adamant that he will not buy a new pair more than once a year. Mm. He loves them. He lives in them. They are his work boots. Mm-hmm. And it's also weird for several reasons, because it's not like he's working construction.
Sure.
He works at a Hertz rental car office.
At the office.
So like, what are you doing in work boots?
But it's like style choice?
Yeah. Like, work shoes, okay. They last long, great. To each their own.
So weird.
Very strange, very meticulous.
Mm-hmm.
However, the week after the peacocks were murdered, Michael wore sneakers to work.
Mm.
And this was so out of the ordinary that multiple people are taking notice, observing, commenting.
Yeah.
Michael, where are your work boots? Michael, what happened to your work boots? Michael, you have new shoes. Mm-hmm. You should wear sneakers more often. It's less weird. Like, multiple people are taking notice and they're telling this to police.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we think it's really out of the ordinary that he's not wearing his work boots.
Yeah.
And police are like, he told us that he threw away the work boots. And then they're thinking, wait a second, we found a boot print of blood, mm-hmm. like a bloody boot print at the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Weird. And it's not like he was a growing boy. Like, his feet didn't change in size, you know, like where his toes would hurt. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no way, like, there's no explanation for that.
A growing boy.
You know?
Seriously.
It's like, what the hell?
Exactly.
And, like, all of this stuff that he's telling police, they're, like, looking at each other like, this is a load of barnacles. Like, this is not making sense at all. There's no way. Because, let alone his decision to go to his in-law's house to get these particle boards. In a Chevy Celebrity. That's the first problem. I don't know anything about cars. I don't know. I just know what colors are, and that's how I can tell what a car is. A Chevy Celebrity, you do not put particle boards. It's not big enough. Like, you can't transport a whole bunch of them. Also, the police were pointing out these particle boards had been in his in-law's house for years. All of a sudden, on this day of the murder, he decides, I'm going to drive 200 miles and I'm going to go get these particle boards. Okay, that's fucking weird. Also, the timeline of him driving, he gets so far and then he's like, I'm tired. And he goes, turns around and goes back. Here's the thing. This is what he said. He was too tired to continue driving, whatever. So he left his house at 9:30 in the morning. Drove towards Vermont, whatever. He stopped at a rest stop in Saratoga at 2 p.m. So then he decided here, he's like, I'm too tired, I can't. And he turns around and he gets home at around 5:36 p.m. So you're telling me it took him almost 5 hours to get to the rest stop. But to get home, it took him 3.5, maybe? Why did it take him an extra 1.5 hours to get to the... It doesn't add up. Did he take a more leisurely, scenic route on his way there? And that's what made him so tired? No, none of this is making sense. Okay? Like, there's no point. Like, it's just, he's trying to do that. I'll tell little bits of the truth. And then maybe, like, it'll cover my lies. No, it's just not working. Hence why they're looking at each other like, what is this guy trying to say here? And then they, of course, were given permission by Penelope, his wife, to look through their car. Because, like you said, Kate, yes, this is my parents. Like, of course you can look through my car. Why would it matter? And they found something pretty interesting. Inside the car, investigators found a teeny tiny drop of blood on the driver's side floor mat. Again, the year 1989. DNA testing was new, and a small speck of blood was not going to yield enough DNA for literally any test at that point in time, unfortunately. So that small piece of floor mat containing the blood sample was labeled and put away into a freezer with the hopes that someday technology would become so far in advance that it would be able to properly test that little amount and yield a result. I love that people, investigators, used to do this with the hopes that technology was getting there. And of course, they were right, as we know. And I just love that they had this inkling, like, we're getting there. I love that. And I love that a lot of these things were kept for so long. Because a lot of places, like, just for example, like, my hospital keeps records of people's, like, urinalysis samples for 6 months, whatever. Why? Same with, like, the DNA. They keep it for years on end, decades. What? This reason. Cannot say the same for the urinalysis. I have no idea why. Anywho, despite the fingers pointing kind of very obviously at Michael, they didn't have any concrete evidence to really nail him directly to the crime. The blood sample wasn't able to be tested, so obviously they couldn't use it in court. For all they knew, it could have been a paper cut from Penny's finger. Like, it really could have been literally anything. So unfortunately, they couldn't do anything with that. And that was the only concrete piece of evidence they had. Could it have been a coincidence that he threw out his work boots? Yes. It really could have been. Could it have been a coincidence that he wrote a suicide note saying, I didn't kill your parents. I'm scared that they're going to pin me for this. Yeah, sure. So they fucking let him go. Because what could they do if they took that to court? That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he couldn't be tried again because double jeopardy or whatever. And that was it. So they let him go. And the investigation stalled. Right? It's like, I'm throwing my hands up right here. Only Katie can see. But like, right? That's it.
And that kind of was it until 31 years later in May of 2020.
What?
Detective Sergeant Samuel Truex, who was the lead investigating officer on the case with the Vermont State Police Major Crime Unit, requested that several items from the Peacock's murder be tested for DNA evidence.
Love that.
I don't know if they tried to test it like before this, or if he just was like, hey, what about the Peacock murder?
Mm.
Or if they were kind of going through old cases methodically and they're like, all right, it's the Peacock's time to shine.
Sure.
Let's look into this more.
Yeah.
Regardless, thank God they did.
Yeah.
Because they still had the tiny drop of blood found in Michael's car from all those years ago.
Yeah.
And they're like, let's test this.
Yeah.
On October 15th, 2020, the lab revealed that they had a match for the blood and it belonged to George Peacock.
Insane.
It was a 1 in a quadrillion match.
Amazing.
To be George's. No question.
No doubt. I love that. I love that they kept it. And that's exactly like the same thing. Like, how did they know 31 years ago to keep that? Again, it just blows my mind and like gives me hope in humanity.
Yeah.
Even though it literally has already like happened. You know, like I love science so much.
Thank God. Mm-hmm. Thank God they had the foresight. Like, yeah, that was really incredible.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's it. That nails Michael to the fucking crime right there. Because why would there be George's blood in the car all the way back in New York? There's your answer right there.
Michael was arrested on October 13th, 2022, almost 2 years later to the day, mm-hmm. at his home in Liverpool, New York, on two counts of second-degree murder. He was 79 years old at the time of his arrest, and his arrest no doubt was postponed because, as we know, 2020, start of COVID, mm-hmm. and after 33 years, the murder of George and Catherine Peacock was finally solved, and it was their son-in-law.
Yeah. Insanity. I'm not sure why it took 2 years. I mean, I'm sure COVID had a factor, probably to get all the things in place and just to make sure that if they were to arrest him and go to court, it would be solid. Because mm-hmm. I know there's so much that we don't even know about how the courts work and all that. But finally, 33 years. For him to be there the whole time and to be originally a suspect. And they knew it too, the whole time. Who just drops a gun in a river? Also, why even bring that up? A gun was not involved.
Correct.
Stupid man. Obviously, Michael pleaded not guilty to the charges, and he was held in custody with a $200,000 bail, which he was unable to post. Unfortunately, however, and as recently as January of 2024, Michael came into some luck regarding his custody. Now, 81 years old, Michael Louise, who of course still maintains his innocence, cannot stand or walk on his own. Now, that's not the luck. Although, I mean, mostly because he's a piece of shit, it is kind of lucky because he sucks. But due to his failing health because of his age, Michael was transported from the state correctional facility that he was being held in to the Mount Ascutney Hospital, which is an acute rehab facility, in July of 2023. This meant that officers from the Vermont Department of Corrections had to be with him 24/7 at this hospital watching him as opposed to being at the prison. So that meant that somebody had to be paid to be there, right? So in just about 6 months, the corrections department racked up a bill of almost $300,000 just housing Michael at this hospital and paying for the officers to watch him 100% of the time. So in the end of December of 2023, just 4 months ago, the corrections department requested a hearing, which was to consider Michael for home detention, in which he would be monitored via ankle bracelet, ironic considering he can't even stand, at this rehab facility. And that was agreed on. Like, they were like, yep. So now Michael is wearing an ankle bracelet. Basically, I know it's not freedom, but he's basically free at this rehab facility without a guard watching him 24/7 simply because it was not affordable. And I get that. That is very pricey. Also, because his bail was only $200,000, that was even more than his bail was posted. So they're like, that is a little much. His bail was $200,000, and now they've changed it to $20,000, which I think is a little insulting to the family. However, it still hasn't been posted, so sucks to suck.
Wow.
And as of right now, that really is the last update, because that was just January of 2024. And obviously the court system, while everyone has the right to a speedy trial, it does take time. So that's it as of right now. And who knows when the trial will happen, if at all. Because he's 81 and he might die before George and Catherine get any justice, which is upsetting for, of course, the family, I'm sure. As it is upsetting to just you and I mm-hmm. sitting here as of like ninth party. Offhand, telling the story. Man, does he look like a piece of shit. I could have predicted he did it as soon as they mentioned him.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
I still don't understand why he brought up a gun. I just, to throw them off?
Yeah, and I guess we don't really know why he did it. Like, it didn't really seem like that money was taken from the home.
Yeah.
I don't know, but he was a piece of shit anyway. He had a rape charge of a 4-year-old girl from, I think it was 1966.
Yeah.
So he's just a foul human being, as we already know, but...
Yeah, 100%. And it was so interesting, too, because in all the articles I read, they just glossed over that real quick. They were like, yeah, so he's a piece of shit, blah, blah, blah. Like, he definitely killed these people. And it was like, oh, my God, like, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and by the way, he raped a 4-year-old girl in 1966. But anyway, so the work boots and, like, the, you know, he put blood. And I was like, we're just going to get away with that?
Yeah, hello?
And back then, the crazy part, too, about him raping this little girl was that he wasn't even charged with rape. He was charged with carnal knowledge, which I was like, what does that even mean? Like,
crazy.
Hello? Like, don't we have carnal knowledge just knowing what murder is? Like, what the hell? He was sentenced to 6 whole years in prison, which is old. I can't. And you know what's funny is that he claims, too, that he had a blackout during that experience. Mm-hmm. So it must be something he's used before. Like, that just must be his go-to.
Yeah.
What a piece of shit. Poor excuse of a human. And you know what? He has potential to win the Elderly Q-Tip Award.
Ooh.
Maybe we'll make a special category for him this year, like a special mention. Because he is a piece of shit, and he looks like a... old, one of those old wispy Q-tips that you find like the bottom of the trash can after you take the bag out and it was forgotten. He's gross.
Oh, that is karma. Let me tell you,
mm-hmm.
Those people do not age well.
No, 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 no. And it's so unfair to this poor couple. And I feel so bad for, of course, Penelope, having been married to this man and have, you know, all these years. Her own husband having killed her parents and trusting him and thinking, you know, of course, you never think that your husband would do that in such a brutal way as well.
I know.
Just terrible. They sounded like lovely people.
The loveliest couple.
Oh, yeah. So, guys, we always want to know what you think. Could you have told us it was Michael Louise from the very beginning? Probably. You can send us your thoughts and feelings about this case on our Instagram, truecrimeany,
all lowercase,
or you can send us an email with your thoughts on this case or a suggestion at truecrimeany@gmail.com.
We also, of course, have a website, truecrimeany.com. Under our contact page, we have a handy dandy submission tool. You can leave us your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, as well as case suggestions based in New England, please. The website submission tool does allow you to be anonymous. That is always an option. But we would love to hear from you either way, whether you guys have cases in New England, cases like this one, cases not like this one, or just let us know your thoughts on this one. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you guys on any and all of the methods we just mentioned.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.